Hi there, and welcome back to Hugo's There 2.0, and this is another author deep dive, this time about Jules Verne, and that's the way I pronounce it, because until just a couple of years ago, I had no idea. It never crossed my mind that he had written originally in a language other than English. No, in fact, his name is closer to Jules Verne, and that's because he was French. And both my guests will be able to pronounce the name more accurately because they both speak French. So that said, I said guests. I have two guests for this podcast. I have Emmanuel from the Stellar podcast, Lafayette We Are Here. Hi, Emmanuel.
Hi.
Hey, good to have you. And I also have Haley from the equally stellar podcast, Hugo Girl. Hi, Haley.
Hey, how you doing?
Yeah, it's good to finally have you. I was, before we were recording, I was like, oh, I've never had Haley on solo. And then I realized, still haven't. So down the road sometime we'll do that. I have to say, when I was originally talking about this, I mentioned to Emmanuel, I said, I feel like Americans don't know that Jules Verne is French. And so I put up a poll on Twitter, and I was not encouraged by the results. It turns out it was just me. 84% of respondents knew he was French. So maybe it's a little embarrassing.
But maybe they cheated. They went to Google first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think I have a handle on how Emmanuel came to speak French. But Haley, what's your story?
I was in college and I didn't know what I was going to be doing or studying, but I knew that I was going to get a minor in French. Like I'd studied it in high school and I loved it. And then I just kept taking classes. And then by my junior year, they were like, well, if you take another 5 extra classes, you can have a double major. So I majored in English and French literature. So
Nice. So did you read some Verne?
We did not read any Jules Verne. We read a lot of things. Mainly, I read things from the 19th century. So,
okay.
Well, yeah, which Jules Verne is from the 19th century, but more like the class. It was like Hugo. Yeah.
Okay. Nice. Yeah. And I do want to make sure to refer people over to Lafayette We Are Here, because you recently did an episode. If people want to know more about more detail about exactly who the man was, Emmanuel did a great job on that recently.
Yes, on my podcast, Lafayette We Are Here, which, as many of you guys know by now, is a French history podcast oriented towards the American public. And my last episode of July 2024 was on Jules Verne. So it's really a kind of biography, you know, going through his whole life, not only the books we're going to talk about here, but from his beginnings to the end, his life in Nantes, in Paris, and in Amiens after that. We can touch on some of those elements, but if you want a complete overview, you can go to my latest episode.
Yeah, excellent. And I think it makes certain sense to bring any of that in that, you know, relates to what he was writing. So I guess that would probably be, well, I guess before then. Haley, anything new with Hugo Girl?
Nope, just hanging out. We took a month off, which we hadn't done in 5 years. And so
that was really fun, actually.
Yeah.
The episode. Yeah. I talked with Amy about that. So,
yeah, I'm glad we had some time off. We mentioned it in the episode that we dropped today, but I've been reading a lot of I get really into like World War II every couple of years. And so I've been reading about the Marine Expeditionary Forces in the Pacific on Guadalcanal. So that's where my head's at.
my dad was so into that. He had bookshelves and bookshelves. Yeah. And I wish that I had ever taken that up. The closest I've come is I watched The Pacific.
Yeah, and that is a launching point. Same with Band of Brothers when I got really into like the Normandy campaign and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, and when I was a kid, you know, we had the mini series War and Remembrance, or I guess the Winds of War and War and Remembrance, and
those Herman Wouk.
Yeah, good stuff.
My first historical research was on World War II, and my first website was a big French website on World War II when I was like 15, 16 years old. So that was also like my entry into getting serious into history. Mm-hmm. So I know I geek about World War II too.
I mean, it's a major event, right? So it makes sense. It's kind of thing that would attract somebody. And if you want more about World War II and Emmanuel's expertise on that, you can check out the Take Me to Your Reader episode on Slaughterhouse-5 or our Hugo's There episode on Blackout and All Clear. Okay, so let's go ahead and start, you know, maybe Emmanuel, without spoiling your episode, like a brief, you know, back of the envelope, I guess, inside flap bio of Jules Verne.
Yeah, so as I said, he was from Nantes, which is in Western France, on like on the Atlantic, almost on the Atlantic coast. And he is, so he's born in 1828, I believe. And so he's really and he dies in 1905. So he's really a 19th century writer, and he's the son of a lawyer. So he first studies law. He's not supposed to become a writer. Mm-hmm. He's supposed to do like that, to work in his office. But Jules Verne is anything but a lawyer. Mm-hmm. I mean, he works a lot. He's very smart, but he wants to create. And that shows when he's very young, he conflicts with his dad a lot. And then he will move to Paris to study law, but he will meet artists and writer and playwrights and all these people. And he's basically in Paris in mid 19th century. Of course, he's not going to do what his dad asked of him. He's going to become a writer. It's going to be a bit tough for the first few years, but then in the 1860s, he's going to be discovered, if you will, by an editor called Etzel, and he's going to start publishing his most famous books, like 5 Weeks in a Balloon, I think, is the first novel that gets recognition, if you will. And then he will have the book we're going to talk about today, From the Earth to the Moon. And a few years later, he's going to have his masterpiece, 20,000 Leagues Under the Seas. Then he's going to go on for a few decades like that. He's going to be snubbed a bit, I would say, in his life by the literary community, just like many science fiction authors still are. You know, and he's going to be a huge influence on everybody after him. People often compare it to H.G. Wells, but they forget that Verne was active 40 years before H.G. Yeah. Wells. And Wells took a lot from him, which is, you know, to be expected. And also Verne is an influence on modern literature. Like if you take the Tintin story, these big adventures, they clearly flow from the kind of story that Verne talks about, because it's not only science fiction, it's basically big adventures. They can be based on prediction, but often they're based on, as we'll talk about, on science and when he was living. He's basically extrapolating from that.
Yeah.
And he's really, to me, an image of 19th century big scientific advances and positivism that is going to be very strong throughout his whole life.
Nice. His background reminds me, so when I went to college, you know, I went to study engineering, but I ended up hanging out with the theater people and the music people and getting involved in music theater and choir and things like that. But I somehow resisted the urge to switch to be an art major. So,
yeah, I did the same thing. I graduated from law school and practiced for a little bit, but then I became a professional writer. So,
right. And you're doing a lot more writing these days, right?
Yeah, well, I write for a company, so like I'm not like writing creative. I mean,
you do some fandom stuff too, though, right?
Yeah, I write for Nerds of a Feather. I do movie reviews, so but nice. Nothing terribly creative, but yeah. I do like to write.
Well, they're very well written.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, indeed. Emmanuel, in school growing up, did you get exposed to a lot of Jules Verne?
Not a lot, but some. I would say
okay.
The book that pretty much every young French kid will read is Around the World in 80 Days because it's a fun story. It's an easy read. It's very short and the concept is fun. Just basically on a wager, this guy named Phileas Fogg goes around the world in 1870-something and he has to make it in 80 days, which at the time is a remarkable feat. You know, you don't have planes. You almost have no trains except within, metropolitan France, stuff like that, you know. It is a feat, it's a big adventure, so it talks about other countries. And at the time, to most people, it's a complete discovery, you know. People just don't know about those other countries. So we did read that book. But I would say, even though we don't read that much Verne at school per se, Verne is a huge persona in France. He's part of the French ethos in some way. Everybody knows of him. He has streets and places all over the place. You know, he's just like, you know, I don't know. Take Edgar Allan Poe in America. Everybody knows him, even if they never read him.
Right, right. Haley, what about you in terms of your, like, what's your history with Verne?
Yeah, so I read, I had a bunch of like the great children's illustrated classics and I read Around the World in 80 Days. And it was like definitely abridged, but you know, it was it's 200 pages of it or whatever. Read...
Show me a 19th century novel that can't be abridged.
Exactly.
Or shouldn't.
Everything but Moby Dick.
Okay.
And then I read 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea in high school as well. And hadn't revisited him since this summer, actually. So, but it's good. One of my first memories of Jules Verne actually is in Back to the Future Part 3. Yep. Doc mentions it to Clara, and I was like, yeah, obviously. So
I remember that scene very well.
Yeah.
That may have been the first I knew of the author, other than, so for me, I had never read any Jules Verne at all. I was only exposed to it through film and television. So I had seen the Kirk Douglas, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. I had seen the Pierce Brosnan Around the World in 80 Days. I've never seen the David Niven one, which is more classic, I think.
Yeah.
Is it David Niven?
There's a new one with David Tennant that's on PBS. It's like an 8-part miniseries. They kind of change it up because it's kind of problematic.
So, okay. I saw the Steve Coogan one as well.
Yeah.
That came out, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. The 1956 Around the World in 80 Days won Best Picture, which is wild.
Wow.
So.
I'll have to check that one out at some point and put it on my list. But yeah, this is basically a new author for me. So I always appreciate that. So Emmanuel, if you were to tell someone where to start, would you tell them to start with Around the World in 80 Days?
It can be a good start because it's a fairly, I would say, it's a light story. It's easy to go in. There's a lot of humor in it. Mm-hmm. It's quite funny. And I would say something like the From the Earth to the Moon could be good for an American because it happens in America. The story is in America, so maybe you could read it. And it's right after the Civil War, so it does have some connection to American history. So that could be a good one too. I would not start with 20,000 Leagues because it's a denser book. It's more complicated, and it's the one of those when he enumerates a lot. You know, when you have those biologists who geek out about species and stuff, and it's relevant. But if that's the one you start with, it could be a bit off-putting, I would say.
I wanted to bounce this off of you. If you think that Jules Verne was sort of like the proto-hard science fiction author, because he really tries to ground things in reality. And when he has a moment to pull on a thread, he just keeps on pulling. And yeah, there's a catalog of fish in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. There's basically an entire chapter all about the moon and how we know, you know, using parallax, how we know how far away it is.
He is, and he's kind of also of the Neil deGrasse Tyson of the time, because there is clearly an intent to educate people. It's part of his, I would say it's part of his contract almost with his editor that he has to have those scientific-based story. So they both entertain and also educate. And all the stuff he talks about is really at the top of scientific knowledge of the time. You know, he did his research very, very well. We can laugh, of course, after some stuff, you know, but it's easy to laugh 130 years after he wrote it and we actually went there, you know, which wasn't the case. We can talk about how we endorse G-force in his novel. But as we all know, by the way, from the third Back to the Future, very scientifically accurate, we cannot go faster than 88 miles per hour with a locomotive. So he didn't have any actual trial to see what the effect of G-force on the human body.
Yes. Yeah. Haley, any comment about the hard science fiction thing?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I wrote down. I would not recommend anybody starting with From the Earth to the Moon. It is like pure physics. I got real bored real quick. It is funny at points. But yeah, it is just, I mean, and it's super smart. Like, I even like, there's one point he's like, this is the exit velocity, like 12,000 meters per second. I was like, I'm going to check that. It's like, he's right. So, I mean, so that's really cool. But it's just, basically, it's just like, it's like the really hard parts of Neal Stephenson books. Like, it's like, I get it. Oof, this is just like a physics lesson.
Right. Yeah. And credit where it's due. You know, he really did come close to all the exit velocities and the transit time to reach the moon. I'm not quite sure where he was going with the exact, you know, the zenith and perigee calculation. I guess for something that can't adjust its trajectory, you have to be a lot more exact. Where manned spaceflight, you know, we can go out of the Earth's atmosphere and do an insertion burn, right, to actually head toward the moon. So we can and use retro rockets and that kind of stuff to correct the course, but you really have to know you got it right if you're just going to aim a big gun at the moon and shoot. I do kind of want to start with From the Earth to the Moon because I feel like that's the science fiction fan choice, right? And Emmanuel, like you mentioned, it's set in America, and it is so American because, unfortunately, because it starts off at the gun club, right? It starts off with the members of the gun club who are responsible for making big cannons and things like that, lamenting the fact that the Civil War is over and there's not really a prospect for another good dust up anytime soon. And so what are they going to do? And somebody's like, what if we shoot the moon?
Yeah, it's funny that his depiction of Americans is basically that you are brave, entrepreneurial, hardworking, open-minded, but also bellicose and trigger-happy, mm-hmm. basically.
Which is so funny because France of the 19th century wasn't the most peaceful place.
Not at all. We had like five changes of government in 80 years. So, and the French are very aggressive and bellicose in their own history. So his perspective at the time.
So another thing to kind of talk about, I mean, anytime you talk about science fiction or writing in the past, right, is looking at their worldviews and seeing, oh, okay, this is, you know, around the world in 80 days, pretty Eurocentric, right? There's some stuff where you're like, we could do better than that description of, you know, folks in Asia nowadays. But he also, it seems like Verne admires lots of different groups of people because with Around the World in 80 Days, you know, I can't tell if he's insulting English people or complimenting them on how cool Phileas Fogg is and how you know, unperturbed he is.
That's the nicest way you could put to describe him.
Yeah.
It's always a bit caricatural. I think he has to at some point because, as I said at the time, most people don't really know about these other people. And, you know, when you read about, for example, when he depicts Italians or Spaniards, they're basically backwards and really over-religious, you know. So it takes the caricature of the time, which is very common, I would say. Most French authors would, of course, say that we, the French, are better than these guys.
Right, right.
You know,
but everyone knows that Americans are like this. Yeah,
exactly. So there's a fair element of that. I would say if you read his whole corpus, it gets nuanced at times. It's not always that obvious and that aggressive. But yeah, he was, of course, an integral part of the preconceived ideas of the time.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of if you've ever read Democracy in America by Alex de Tocqueville, like he went and like traveled around America for years. And if you read that book, you're still like, wow, us Americans have not changed very much. And, you know, having the gun club with people that have missing limbs from wars and shooting guns, and they're just like, give me more guns. Like, it's still true 150 years later.
Yeah.
Especially so when we see it from an outside perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not that far. I'm in Montreal, but from our side of the border, what some stuff that happens in the States is just flabbergasting.
Yeah. I can feel you side-eyeing us from up there. And it reminds me of the Onion post that is always posted every time there's a mass shooting in the U.S. that says, nothing can be done about this as the only country where this regularly happens.
It's true.
But despite all this, he does present Americans as people that do try to solve this insoluble problem, mm-hmm. how to get to the moon. And he does point out a few times, only the Americans could do it. Only you have this spirit and this capacity and to make such an endeavor true. But halfway through the book, of course, the main hero is France. <Of course. laughs> And what I did like is that he comes in very late in the story. He comes in very late and he's like, hey, your whole design, you know what? Put a hatch in it. I'm going to go into that shell to the moon. What? Yeah. Oh, am I almost there, by the way?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I don't know. Maybe it's a little surprising that he put America forth as the you know, where the ingenuity is. Because England was still a gigantic empire at this point. It was starting to wane, right? And kind of by the time World War II was over, it was, you know, basically gone.
You'll have a hard time finding a Frenchman praising England.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Especially at the time. You know, those two countries have been at war for like five centuries on and mm-hmm. off. And even though there's been a peace period at that time, tensions were coming back. It's a bit complicated, but, you know, right. Americans, French like Americans more than English almost all the time, you know, so he's not, he's no exception in that regard. Plus the Americans did have that reputation of being very courageous, you know, mm-hmm. it's the time of the frontier and all that stuff. So it does, and your country is still not that well defined in the Europeans' minds. So it is very exotic to them. So I think that's part of the reason. Like the English are enemies, but also they're common. You know, we know the English. We've known them for 1,000 years, and we each other for 1,000 years. So not that interesting. But the Americans were very interesting to the French people at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he was right. Like England and France would never go on to explore the moon. They would never have huge space programs. That's just a fact. True. So
that's true. In the end, he was right.
I do want to mention to folks, I don't think that I mentioned this while we were recording, that From the Earth to the Moon is, it's more than half of a book, as Emmanuel said before we were recording. You know, there is a sequel to it, which I don't, how much longer after did it come out?
It came out right after, like a year or two after. Okay. And can I spoil it so people,
is that okay? Well, yeah, from the Earth to the Moon, it does end on something of a cliffhanger.
Yeah, basically they, so spoiler times, everybody, basically they managed to get people in a shell. They shoot it with a huge cannon. And as Haley explained, you have all the engineering and physics behind it before in the book. So you have a very good idea of what's going on. But they actually miss. So instead of landing on the moon, they go into orbit around it, which is actually a good thing. Because, you know, what happens in the second book, very broadly, is that they turn around the moon for some time and they get hit by an asteroid, which changes their trajectory. They come back to Earth thanks to that, because at some point they leave the gravity of the moon and they get grabbed by the gravity of the Earth, which is fairly accurate, I would say. And they land in the ocean. I don't remember which one. But the image, the drawings they did at the time, the illustration of that capsule in the ocean with those teams of boats going around to extricate the astronauts from it, it looks like an Apollo capsule. It's incredible when you think about it. And to me, I can't imagine that those guys who designed that capsule didn't have some Jules Verne story in their minds.
Yeah.
I'm sure you know that he was an inspiration to maybe kids who later became engineers or scientists, what have you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you've seen that story a bunch of times, right? Why do you think we ever had flip phones, right? Because of communicators on Star Trek. You know, why do electric cars sound like electric cars from movies? Because they have to have a speaker in them so that they make some noise. And the engineers were like, well, it should sound like an electric car then.
Yeah. So funny you mentioned that. So it was the Pacific, and I read this on Wikipedia today. During their return journey from the moon, the crew of Apollo 11 made reference to Jules Verne's book during a TV broadcast. The mission's commander, Neil Armstrong, said 100 years ago, Jules Verne wrote a book about a voyage to the moon. His spaceship, Columbia, sick, took off from Florida and landed in the Pacific Ocean after completing a trip to the moon. It seems appropriate to us to share with you some of the reflections of the crew as the modern day Columbia completes its rendezvous with the planet Earth. So...
And the influence on U.S. adventures doesn't stop there. For example, in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the famous submarine is called the Nautilus. And the first U.S. nuclear submarine was called the Nautilus in honor to Jules Verne's submarine. So there is a back and forth between Jules Verne and the United States. And I would say broadly Western culture, more than people often know. But everybody knows the Nautilus. Everybody knows Captain Nemo. He's really part of our culture on both sides of the Atlantic.
Yeah, even thinking of Finding Nemo, right?
Yeah,
it's not a coincidence. I want to back up for a second. So the previous Zoomed Out episode that just posted at the beginning of August is about translated science fiction. And of course, all of Jules Verne's works were translated from French into English. And I think my guest mentioned that some of them were really bad translations, or that there would be someone would be thinking, oh, Americans don't care about this, and so just like eliminate an entire subplot. Are you aware of any of the travails of the translation?
I do know that many of them were translated at the time because Verne was very popular outside of France as he was writing.
Okay.
And I don't know, I don't think they had that high quality standards back in the 19th century for translating work. Basically, you want to make it available as quickly as possible. End of story, and Verne probably never read the English versions of his own stories.
Okay.
So if they kept that version going for long, that could be part of the explanation.
Could be like they got somebody who said that he read French, kind of like Brad Pitt in Inglourious Bastards spoke Italian. Buongiorno.
Because when you read Verne, and Haley can comment on that, when you read Verne in the original French, he's a very plain writer. He's very clear, very, very clear. You know, there is no way you can misunderstand him. He's not a Hugo or a Dumas who plays with words a lot.
No.
He's not like that. He's very straightforward. He's kind of like Asimov.
I was thinking like he's like Asimov. Like he explains everything, lays it out. Everything has a reason.
Yeah. Maybe not as bland as Asimov. He does try to color things a bit, and his characters are not as dull, but still, he is very straightforward. So I think it could be very translated perfectly because he doesn't play with the French language as much as Victor Hugo would.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not poetic. It's just matter of fact. I think he relies more on his plots than like his character development or his like twists. But I think it's. I actually thought about breaking it out and reading some French, but all the science and From the Earth to the Moon, I think, would have been a challenge for me. Like, I don't like to read science texts in English, let alone French. So,
So I guess maybe not as many things to get lost in translation because of not trying to, you know, because that's one of the things, right? And there's ways to do puns, for instance, that work in one language but not another, right? And so when you translate that, you have to figure out how to render it.
Yeah, I don't think there's a single pun in these books.
No,
not even the funnier one, like 80 days, Around the World in 80 Days. I think it can be translated perfectly because there is not, even the puns, the few that are there are very straightforward. They're not, as she said, it's not poetic. He doesn't play with the language.
So I had a question about From the Earth to the Moon because the president of the gun club is named Impey Barbicane, and I've never heard such a name. And I wondered, is it a joke in French? Is it Pig Latin? You know, I was never able to figure it out.
I thought it was very Dickensian, just like Impey, like imperial, warlike, and then Barbicane, like barbarous. So
yeah, that works. Okay, I hadn't thought of it in thinking about Dickens characters and that kind of thing. Where yeah, there were some great names in Dickens.
And I do know that he read a lot of English literature. He was a huge fan of Poe, for example. Mm-hmm. And I think he was very aware of how Anglophones represented themselves in literature. So that could be an explanation of that. But it doesn't make any funny thing in French. It's just how a French man would imagine a president of such an association be named.
Okay. Yeah, I think if he was writing today, it would be the similar version would be like, Chuck McDanger or something. Right. Just something like uber masculine. I don't know. So.
Right, right. Johnny Squarejaw.
Yeah.
Yes. I did want to ask because in one of the big lists, Haley, in From the Earth to the Moon, there's a big list of exotic foods in America when the entire, basically entire United States comes to watch the launch.
Yeah.
And some of them are definitely killed by the launch. It will just, he kind of yada yadas that. But he presents stuffed monkey as a Southern delicacy. And, you know, I know Atlanta isn't exactly the deep South, but
it's stuffed monkey.
And there are no native monkey species in the United States.
No. I think he was just taking the piss, as the British would say.
You just
fried monkey, maybe, but stuffed monkey.
Right, there we go.
You just destroyed my hopes, Haley. I was figuring next time I went down south, I could discover something.
Fried. Well, I always think of chilled monkey brains from Indiana Jones. So
yeah.
Happy memories.
Yeah. That very, very respectful depiction of you know, totally. Indian food. Okay. Anyhow. So why don't we move on and let's talk about Around the World in 80 Days. I mean, we don't have to dwell super long on any of these because I think they're, you know, we mentioned there's a number of adaptations of Around the World in 80 Days. And I thought it was amusing that, you know, my only reference for it really was that I completely forgot the Steve Coogan movie until we started recording. But the Pierce Brosnan one was a television miniseries.
Oh, yeah.
And I just assumed that it was a pretty straight adaptation, but there's a lot of differences. You know, things that are in common are the, you know, the Indian princess and Passepartout, the French servant, and Phileas Fogg, obviously, and the lawman trying to hunt him down. But some of the modes of where he gets from one place to another definitely change.
I think they do that to make it more interesting because, like, there is a lot of train and boat, and I think mixing it up just a little bit makes it more fun.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, I mean, it is interesting, though, that they get on the train and the train only takes them so far. And, well, now you have to travel another 40 miles to catch the next next train.
I was reading about the more recent one with David Tennant, and it's very modern with, like, you know, politically more appropriate sensibilities. And so they turn Fix into a woman, and she accompanies them, kind of like Nellie Bly, a journalist. It appears they get rid of the entire Indian Queen subplot, which I think is for the best. Mm. And just, you know, they just add more diversity to it. But I think it's interesting that the story keeps living on. Just, we want to change bits, but keep the overall theme. So,
yeah. Emmanuel, were these novels serialized or were they published in novel form?
I would say this one, I think, was serialized. Many of them were. Some were released directly as novels, but often they were serialized in, actually I have the name, in the Magazine of Education and Recreation. So just by the name of the magazine, you figure, you know, the point of it. And funny thing about the adaptations of Around the World in 80 Days, even during Verne's life, it was adapted in plays, and often by himself, or he was part of the production, if you will. And during those plays, you would have big changes, sometimes because it was just not practical to try to represent this or that event, but also because Verne understood perfectly the difference between a play and a novel, and that you want to show basically the same idea, but represented differently. And he was perfectly fine with that. He started actually as a playwright when he first started writing. So he was very aware of the differences between the original novel and adaptation. And you can tell that to Colin.
I was going to say, Jules Verne is now dead to Colin. No, I mean, Ray Bradbury was similar, right? Because he wrote a lot for the stage as well, and he often changed things drastically.
I wonder if, like, all of the different forms of transportation, it's like a 19th century Fast and the Furious. It's just like, man, there's like a boat, there's an elephant, there's a steamship. Like, people were just like excited to hear about all these different types of modern conveyances that they might never see. So,
Well, he is, all these stories to me have a common thread, is that they show human achievement. They show what we can do or what we could do in the to them near future. And it's all, in my mind, it's all part of that very 19th century way of thinking that a French philosopher named Auguste Comte called positivism. Basically, we're advancing, progressing. The human race as a whole is advancing. Because to them, if you look at somebody living in France in 1870 and you compare them to 1770, it's day and night. Like, it's not, it's as modernized so fast, where if you were to compare 1770 to 1670, it's almost the same, you know. So a year of all the centuries before, the progress is very slow. But in the 19th century, the progress was huge. And not only in France, but of course, Verne being French, he sees the French perspective. So to him, humanity is going very fast and advancing, progressing. You see medicine advances. He's seeing engineering achievements. I mean, at the time, you know, it's crazy. Like, you have Louis Pasteur, who helps make vaccines come along. You have technological achievement that were completely unbelievable maybe 20 years before. Trains are starting to go everywhere. So imagine living in such a world where you see advancement in such a bright light. You make it part of your story. And that's something he clearly puts into his story with many different forms, either by going on the moon or by traveling around the world or by going under the seas or going to the center of the earth. All these books try to represent some aspect of that positive progress.
I like it. I mentioned that Around the World in 80 Days and Places is definitely kind of Eurocentric, and the epitomized probably most when Passepartout becomes separated from Fogg, right? Because he makes the boat and Fogg does not. And he arrives in Japan and basically thinks to himself, I can make a living busking for a couple of weeks until Fogg shows up, because, you know, these Japanese could not fail to appreciate good European singing.
He would only be so wrong.
Poor reason.
I was thinking about this, and one of the notes I wrote down is, why is it so fun to watch unbridled wealth move mountains? Because, like,
right,
he's like, you know, tear your ship apart and start burning it. I don't care. Like, here's $1 million. Like, it's just so fun to watch somebody who's that rich just, like, bend the world to his will.
Yeah. And, you know, in this book, you know, not to spoil too much, but, you know, he essentially doesn't really make any money on the bet, right? Because he spends his entire fortune in order to make the trip. He does come out with a wife who proposes to him, which I thought was nice.
And it's something that to us French is very British. He did this whole wager for nothing for the sport.
Right.
And that's a perspective. I mean, it's a caricature, but that's the idea that a Frenchman would have of a English high society member. You know, he would do anything on a bet, on a whim.
Right.
And that's something you'll find in those stories, that you'll have those national elements. Here we have an English gentleman in a voyage to the center of the earth, a journey to the center of the earth in English, I believe. We have a German mineralogist from the earth to the moon. We have those Americans in 20,000 Leagues Under the Seas. We have a French professor. And he was always trying to put those elements of each country's, what he believes is part of their cultures. And, you know, as you may know, since last Friday with the opening ceremony, the French can be quite provocative. So expect some discoveries.
It was so good.
And anything else to talk about the Around the World in Later Days? I mean, you know, it is very, what's the word, peripatetic, right, from one place to another.
It's fun,
Yeah. And it definitely reads like a serialized novel, where you can just pick it up and go, you know, it doesn't have the previously on, you know, kind of thing that you get sometimes in serialized stuff. Like I think of some Lovecraft where like the first 25% of any new chapter is recapping what was in the previous one. And perhaps that's edited around when things are compiled into novels. But yeah, it's fun. And the fog, you know, is not presented as in really any kind of negative light. You know, he talks about how he plays cards and wins money, but then he just donates it to charity, right? He's not really interested in expanding his own wealth. And so
it's very neutral. It's just like, this is a weird dude. He's got a thing that he likes. He's very into his routine.
Well, Verne characters tend to be nerds and to not care about wealth. That's also a common thread. They usually care about the adventure or the mission, what have you. But wealth, you can see, doesn't appreciate characters who want to achieve wealth or fortune or glory for the sake of itself. There was always something higher in his stories.
All right. Maybe 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Talk about that for a little bit. I feel like those are three good works to kind of introduce somebody to the author. No, I mean, not that I'm an authority on that. I've read those three and that's all.
Horrible.
Okay. I will say that I have a really hard time saying 20,000 leagues. I've been saying 2,000 Leagues Under the Sea for several months.
It's the kind of title that clearly flows better in French. 20 milieux sous les mers. It just rolls off the tongue a lot easier than 20,000 Leagues Under the Seas. You feel like you're recitating something.
Yeah. And I thought it was under the sea, and it is in English for a lot of ways, but then the French one translates sometimes to its seas, which we don't say seas very often. We say, I think it could have just said under the ocean, but yeah.
It's very apt though, because he definitely describes traveling in many of the different seas, right? All the way in Indian Ocean, in the Mediterranean, you know, Pacific, Atlantic, Arctic.
It's got big Frankenstein's monster energy in terms of like, it's not Frankenstein, it's this. So.
Right.
Well, you could argue that a submarine is a kind of Frankenstein. It's a character in itself.
Right. Yeah. And like I saw the movie on television when I was a kid. And so basically all that I remembered was being kind of bored until the squid showed up. And then that was awesome. So I didn't really know much about the actual plot, and I really enjoyed the way the novel starts. And I didn't know exactly what was happening when it talked about the ships being rammed by something. I thought, oh, this is the squid. We've already met the squid, you know? And then when they go out there and they start harpooning it, and I'm like, metal. Oh, okay. I think I know what this is now. So it kind of surprised me, and I really enjoyed the book. I think I would really not like it on a reread because of all the ways that I don't appreciate hard science fiction, where yes, I'm glad that you did all that research and all that homework and you spilled it all out onto the page for me. And one time I can usually get through that, maybe not with the Mars books, but with The Martian and Jurassic Park and most Michael Crichton. I can appreciate that one time through. And then when I reread it, I'm just annoyed.
It's because it's partly because I think once you learn it, it kind of gets spoiled. Like, okay, so that's how he makes the potatoes and the Martian to go. Yeah. So there's no element of surprise left. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say the most unbelievable thing in here for me is that people were eating on board the Nautilus and mistook seafood for anything but seafood. that's not a thing. People who don't like seafood don't like any seafood.
That's true.
And to us, it all tastes the same. So, and what it tastes like is seafood, even seaweed, like seaweed chips, terribly fishy. Yeah. For those of us who can't eat fish, and it's a bummer.
Yeah. Just think about how good their cholesterol was though, probably.
Right. Well, but of course, you know, the Canadian and the Frenchman were, especially the Canadian was constantly wanting to get on land and shoot something with hooves, you know,
I've got to eat meat.
Yeah.
The Ned Land character is a funny one.
Yeah.
It's clearly a kind of a comic relief, especially his duo with Conseil. I don't know how they translated his name in English.
It's just Conseil.
Conseil, the same. Okay.
I guess it'd be like if your name was Advice.
Exactly. That's what it means.
Yeah.
And he is a good advisor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's like Passepartout, if Passepartout was in the military. He's just like,
yes,
got his shit together. He's loyal to a fault and has absolutely no personality.
Yeah. Willing to lay down his life for his master.
Yep.
Yeah.
Whereas Ned Land is always unhappy about something and he wants to hit something. And you have the professor in the middle trying to find reason somewhere around that. But the sense of awe in the professor is really interesting, I find, when he discovers the Nautilus and all those species. And you can feel like he's geeking out completely, you know, which is a sentiment I can share.
Yeah, he's having the time of his life, even though he's technically a prisoner for like the rest of his life. And he's just like, well, at least the view is great.
Right.
Exactly. He's a prisoner within the most advanced technological achievement of humanity. So he's like, I'll take it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's like, well, it could be worse. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing that I admire about Jules Verne is he really does write in that professorial kind of voice where he's going to tell you some things. And if you're someone who's in the know about science at all, you're going to be like, but what about? And then he'll answer that up to a certain point, right? Up to the level of his knowledge. You know, he'll say something like water is the solution to the, of course, crushing acceleration that someone would experience on being launched out of a gun. Yeah, yada, yada is it. And you go, okay, that's fine. That's where he crosses over into the speculative part of it. But he does a good job of kind of laying that groundwork. And you're like, well, okay, how are you going to deal with the buildup of carbon dioxide in here? And he talks about it. And then, of course, it becomes a crucial plot point later on.
Yeah. And he does a better job of it than I think Asimov does. Because sometimes Asimov is just like, and then I press my anti-gravity button, and that's how it works. Like,
right.
At least he lays down, you know, the groundwork for it.
Yes, I applied hand wavium, and it was all better.
That's science, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and the thing, he always tried to have this balance between scientific facts and engineering and actual adventure and story and plot moving forward, which is not easy to achieve, honestly. It's really easy to get either very boring or, as Ailey said, just press a button, problem solved, and no more discussion. He struggled. That's something during my research I did on my own episode. At first, he struggled to find that balance, and his editor was a lot of help at the beginning to find it, to say, because he was putting less scientific elements in it at the very beginning, like his short stories and stuff. And his editor said, no, put more of it, to the point that people will learn a lot from those. And remember, at the time, this stuff is not taught at school. Most people don't actually go to school at the time. So it's very good in that way. And something that you can't find really with any authors that I found from that era. It's very unique. It's very modern. And we mentioned before that he was snubbed by lots of the literature community at the time. Some people actually loved him. One of them was Alexandre Dumas, the famous author who wrote The Three Musketeers, for example. But Alexandre Dumas was himself snubbed by many people because his grandfather was black.
Yep.
So he had black ancestry. And of course, the French society being what it is, many racists and people accused him of being a descendant, they called him a Negro to his face.
Yeah.
You know, and he would play with that. In one of the stories, some people say, oh, you must know everything about apes being who you are, you know, this kind of stuff, you know, very, very bad. And he answered, yes, sir, my family my family ends where your begins or something like that. He wavers the thing against him. And because he was Alexandre Dumas, you know, you don't try to attack a guy like that.
Right, stupid. Right.
But he helped
clapped back
Verne.
Hard.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, he helped Verne. He loved his work. But Verne never made it into the Académie Française, which is like the elite core of the French writers. And I have an anecdote about that. Verne tried a few times, but there was only 40 seats, I think. And you need to wait until one dies to have a seat available. They call the immortals because of that. Mm-hmm. And he never made it. And his nephew, who was, let's say, had mental issues, severe mental issues. So that's the son of his brother, Paul, who he was very close to. One day, his nephew decided he wanted to help his uncle get into the academy. So what he did, he waited for him at his house after he went to a social club, and he shot him in the leg, basically to have sympathy on his uncle. And he said, I did this for you so you could get into the Académie Française. And of course, it didn't work. Poor guy, the poor nephew Gaston, I think was his name, spent the rest of his days in an asylum, died in the 1930s. And Verne limped for the rest of his life.
Oh,
so that's a weird story, but it is true.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
the science was so solid on the attempt, too, you know?
Yeah. Also, like him writing in the 1850s and 60s, like that's just a stack time for French literature. So, yeah.
Lots of competition.
Yeah.
Yep. You got to pack the academy.
Expand the academy. Mm-hmm.
You know, you have people like Hugo, Maupassant. All these people are from that era. Yeah. It's one of the most prolific period of French literature, as Haley said.
Yeah. Yep. Captain Nemo is definitely an interesting character, and like he's so alienated from the world of humanity, right? And I know in one way I kind of want to reread it and do a character study of him and really really dig into like where did that? And the book does tell you, right? He's mourning, and his mourning has turned him into this underwater incel kind of, and it radicalized him really in a lot of ways, I had always thought of Captain Nemo as a good guy. And so then reading this, I'm like, oh, this is not a nice man.
No.
Yeah, yeah. Very flawed.
He's one of the world's first eco-terrorists.
So. Yeah.
Kinda. But you can see Verne also explains his story. He's a suffering man. He's a brilliant man. Yeah. And he's also present in another book, The Mysterious Island, where we meet him. And that's when we learn he is actually Indian. So he's one of those big characters who are not Europeans, and that's something that at a time could be shocking.
Yeah, especially given what you were talking about you know, racism in the society.
Oh yeah, totally. And I'm certain if you were to ask most Frenchmen in 1880, what do you think of Indians? Oh, they're savages. They would not go beyond that, you know. Mm. And sometimes in Verne's book, people like in the Pacific are presented as savages. That's the word they use. So having one of those quote-unquote savages being an extremely brilliant man that actually outsmarted many Europeans is quite something, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, that makes me kind of interested back in Around the World in 80 Days. You know, you have this pairing of an Indian woman and an English man. And not, of course, that kind of thing was unheard of. There has been race mixing for a long time that was largely due to rape, where it's not presented that way in Around the World in 80 Days. I'd be curious what sort of adversity, you know, that couple would face in England of the time, or if they would. I don't know.
I mean, yeah, in the 19th century, England and France are more alike than different, despite their personality differences. So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Don't forget those were colonial countries, yeah. So they had lots of back and forth. And the French were especially used to having colonial people coming to the metropole, coming to France. I think it was more common than in England, in part because of the proximity. You know, lots of people came from North Africa to France, which is just across the Mediterranean. Mm. And actually, at the time of Verne, although Verne was anti-colonialist and he was anti-slavery, he recognized this as a fact. You know, you just have this crossover between the two, and it was part of his stories in his world. So it was not uncommon, let's say, even in 1885, to see black people in Paris because of the colonies.
Mm. Anything else you want to talk about 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea? It is a good adventure, and it is definitely a a meatier book than the other two.
Yeah, I would say I love all things aquatic. I just got my scuba certification this summer, so this was a blast to read. And I think one thing that maybe might appeal to us less than someone reading this in 1880, for example, is like I've seen so many nature documentaries where I've seen things that humans didn't look at for all of history. And so I think even though he describes them well, like I've seen these in high def. So like I think we're spoiled, basically. So.
Mm-hmm. But the adventures in it are fantastic. The action scenes are actually very good.
Yeah.
The action scenes are really tremendous.
Some of the underwater hunt is wonderful.
And the maelstrom at the end and all that stuff, you know, it's very compelling, very well written, to be honest.
So let's talk about some other titles. I mean, I feel like these are ones that everybody knows about, right? And maybe Journey to the Center of the Earth as well. Are there any other kind of off the beaten path things? Haley, have you read anything from Verne that was rarer?
These are the only three that I've read, so.
Okay.
If you want something different, you can try Michel Strogoff. It's a story set in Tsarist Russia, and you're basically following a courier, this man, Michel Strogoff. He's a courier, I think, working for the Tsar Alexander, not sure which one, maybe the first anyway. And so that's not at all speculative fiction. It's really just a story set in another country. And actually did a lot of those stories that were not speculative at all. They were just based abroad. There is always some exotic elements in it. There is something like The Children of Captain Grant, which is your friend, a captain. Jules Verne was himself a sailor. He loved everything aquatic, just like Haley. So lots of his stories involve boats and traveling on boats and the seas and oceans. And what else could be interesting? So, I mean, he wrote like 80 books. So, you know, I'm sure you could find a few that would be to your taste. I would recommend the ones, I would say, that he wrote in his first 15 years of writing, because the ones that come after is in his later life are very dark, actually. Not all of them, but some of them are very dark. He actually invents a character who's basically the mad scientist who invents a device that could end the world. Basically a nuclear bomb. You know, he is before Einstein was a 5-year-old at the time. You know, so he invents a lot of dark stuff because he had those very dark experiences in his life. I mentioned being shot by his nephew, but that's actually the least of it. He had lots of trouble with his own son. He was snubbed. He had some issues, and his health was declining. So all this made this very bright Verne into a darker Verne. And himself, just so we can talk about him, about his own character, even though you have those stories that are very open, very adventures, himself, he was a very hard man in his own life. He was very strict. He was tougher on his own boy than his dad was with him, which is funny when you think about it, because he basically rebelled against his dad. And when his own son did the same, he could not take it. So he was a hard man on many levels, and it shows in his later stories.
Interesting. I just reminded myself that for most of my life, when I've thought of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and this is probably why I truncate it to 2,000, is because I don't know what a league is. And so I pictured that as depth, not distance traveled. And reading it this time, I thought, oh, okay, it's definitely the distance that they traveled under the sea.
Yeah. And when you read that something, when I read it, I figure, oh, that must be tough for Americans, because all the references for length are, they're all in the old French way, like the leagues and all that stuff that even to modern French readers would make no sense, because we use the metric system. And even though the metric system was law at the time, people used their old system for years. Like just like here in Canada, we have the metric system. Everybody tells their weight in pounds and size in feet and inches. Nobody tells them in metric. In France, they do, but not here. So that's an example. And it was the same for them. But what I do find very interesting with Verne is, honestly, the legacy of it all. The very long-lasting legacy, I would say. I mean, how many kids became engineers or scientists because of him?
Yeah,
that's something not many authors can claim, honestly. It's quite breathtaking. He was part of the whole movement of that 19th century going into the 20th, where science and technology clearly took a part in our lives that it never did before, but is part of the good aspect of it, if you will, good aspect of it. I always think about those NASA guys. I'm sure they all read the Julian stories, or they know of it. And it's part of that scientific spirit that I find very admirable in many ways.
Yeah. It's easy to imagine Monsieur Eiffel reading this, you know, when he's a young man, and then being like inspired to do hard physics. So,
yeah.
Yeah, actually, it was contemporary, so maybe he read it as an adult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, in terms of one of the places of science fiction in society, and the good thing that it does is kind of encourage people to think speculatively, because there's always this tendency, when you look at the history of science, there's a tendency to come to a point and think, we've discovered everything. And it takes some effort to push through into the next revolution, and that's, you know, that's where the next discoveries come from, and where you know, you end up getting to the moon, and you end up doing discovering the Higgs boson, right? Because people started thinking more speculatively about things and understanding everything that they can understand. And you know, we're kind of getting to one of those points again where we feel like, well, we found the Higgs, and now what is there left to discover, right? And we'll see what happens.
Leave it to the French to make a nice revolution out of anything. And it's interesting you say that, because when you look at the history of literature before Verne, especially in France, some authors already touched the idea of going to the stars or to the moon. There is this author, I think I evoked it last year with you, Seth, called Cyrano de Bergerac, not the character, the author of that name, who wrote a story of going to the moon in a rocket ship in the 17th century. So those people had ideas that would actually come true down the line. Voltaire wrote a story that happens in the stars. You have a Saturnian coming to Earth, and that the story calls Micromega. So those ideas were clearly around with all the discoveries in the science that that was happening at the time. And even when there was no way of understanding, of knowing how we could make something like that happen, but they could see it would happen at some point. So they had this vision, they had this perspective, they had this perspicacity of saying, you know what, it's going to take time, yes, but we'll get there. We just have to keep pushing and imagining. And that's something that we often lack, this imagination that those authors had. And that's something that could be very inspiring to many people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you have debates about science fiction, right? Should it be forward-looking and positive and... You end up with the, you know, the sad puppies and the rabid puppies stuff, right? We want the science fiction that we had when we were kids, you know, that was positive and talked about all this stuff and didn't get into social issues. And the problem is, you know, the science fiction can kind of help correct society, and so there is a place for all of it. And I like a good, you know, throwback story. It was fun reading these and kind of soaking in that kind of positivism of it. And it's good to do that now and then, but, you know, it's good to take a dour look as well sometimes. All right. So if you were to assign any further reading for Haley or for me, since our tally is up to 3, where would you send us?
For your next reading, did you read Journey to the Center of the Earth?
No, I haven't. I haven't read that one. I have heard it's a journey partway to the center of the Earth, but
surprise, surprise.
It is funny. It is a nice one, because here is the story of this German mineralogist and his nephew trying to find the center of the Earth. And of course, they discuss the theories of his nephew is persuaded that basically they're going to melt because it's so hot down there. And he says, no. Anyway, they go and they have a big adventure. And there's a lot of interaction between the two, which are quite funny. And there's a whole part where basically they discover a world under the earth, if you will, and it's very bright and very colorful and very
interesting. It's a hollow earth kind of thing, like in the MonsterVerse movies.
Yeah, and it's so it is. I would say it's one of those I would recommend, because it's lots of fun. There is less description and listing than in 20,000 Leagues, so it's a bit easier, it's a bit shorter too. 20,000 Leagues is bigger than most of his novels. Most of his novels would say 300-400 pages ish. 20,000 Leagues is more than 600 range, so it's a bit heavier.
Darn, was it really that long? I have an ebook, and I don't do pages. I do like time left in the book. So
yeah,
like,
me too.
So I had no idea how long it was. I know it took me a long time to read, but
my paperback is about 600 pages. So
damn, that explains that.
Yeah, I did most of it on audio. So it said it was a 13-hour book. So that's fairly long.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I have never listened to a complete audiobook. I can't concentrate. I'll lose it and then have to go back. Lose it, go back. So
hey, Emmanuel, you're kind of similar on that, right? You don't usually care for audiobooks.
No, on a reread, yes. Yeah. I will, but on a first read, it's not. No, I don't. It just doesn't stick in my mind as same. Well.
Yeah.
Plus, to me, reading with a book in my hand is just a pleasure. It's something that's very soothing to me, very relaxing. Just sitting with the book, I actually like the object of the book, you know.
Yeah.
And I love listening to podcasts, including yours, Haley. And
thank you.
True. And you know, this I love to have those interactions or to learn about something. I listen to lots of history podcasts, for example. But something creative, something of fiction, I have to have it imagined in my mind, and that's something I cannot do if somebody else's voice is doing it for me.
Yeah.
To me, it's detrimental. So to each their own. I'm not judging people who enjoy it in that form. But to me, it's a layer between me and the story that prevents me from enjoying it as much.
Yeah. I think it's a rare audiobook that sticks with me the same way an iRead does. Every now and then, there's something that is so well done that it really, really works for me.
I just had a flash of another story you could read that is very nice. It's called Robur le Conquérant, or Robur, R-O-B-U-R, the Conqueror. This one is about flying machines. And it's a direct inspiration for the Japanese anime movie, Castle in the Sky. I don't know if you know it. It's a Ghibli movie. It's a great movie. But you see the machines in that movie, and you read the Jules Verne story, it's the same machines. Basically, you have those balloons with des hélices.
Propellers.
Forget the name in the propellers, thank you. With propellers. And they look like boats with balloons and with ropes suspended and those propellers, and they fly around. And so at the time, it was very, you know, original. And it's a bit of an adventure story, of course. Yeah. And so this one is a nice read too. And it was written after the others we talked about.
Okay. I think it is interesting that Journey to the Center of the Earth, like that is the most one that's still ahead of where we are. I saw a YouTube video the other day that was about like attempts to drill as far into the crust as possible. And we have not gotten very far. And that's really interesting that you know, we haven't caught up with Jules Verne yet.
Correct.
And then it's just liquid hot magma for like 50,000 miles.
That's a small issue, yeah.
Yeah. Of course, eventually you get through the bottom and hit the shell of the turtle. But
turtle's all the way down.
Yes. Yeah. I was throwing out a sop to the flat earthers there. So.
Yeah. I was going to show y'all. I got an ad years ago on TikTok for these things called book wallets. And I had a Count of Monte Cristo one for years, but I lost my wallet. But I got a new one, and it's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And it's like a little book, but it's where I keep my credit cards and my ID. I love
it. Oh, that's fun. So.
A lot of people think it's a New Testament, but
I was going to say it looks like a little Gideon Bible.
It's not. So many like people that know me, I'm like, you know, I don't carry around a Bible. Come on. But yeah, so it's just, I love it. So
that's funny. I like that idea.
Yeah. So if you just Google, like, I'm not plugging them, but just like book wallets, there's a bunch of good ones. I'm still waiting for them to do a Moby Dick one. They haven't yet, but this is the next best thing. So.
Okay. I mean, it kind of suffice it to say, right? Like if you're somebody who like something like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, you might want to read The Mysterious Island, because that's another Nemo story, right? I saw it when I logged it on Goodreads. It said Captain Nemo number 2 for 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And I thought, what? Why is that number 2?
Yeah, he's actually a small part of the story, but yeah, he's in it. He's in the end of that story.
Okay. In my mind, I have to admit that sometimes I get H.G. Wells and Jules Verne mixed up. And you know, I think of one of the titles and think, now, which one of them was it that wrote that?
Actually, during his lifetime, sometimes H.G. Wells was called the English Verne, and he hated that because he wanted to be his own man, you know, which, you know, fair.
Yeah.
But he was clearly a successor, you could say, to a point to Verne, you know, and he did great stories too. I mean, I don't want to lower him.
Yeah. Okay, I think we can probably leave it there. Emmanuel, so where can people find you?
Yes, so they can find me on LafayettePodcast.com or in any podcast app that they want. I'm also present on many social media sites like Blue Sky and Threads and the Meta ones. Not on X anymore. and I'd be happy to have your comments on my episodes. And the next one might be of interest to you because it's in August 2024. I did an interview with an American historian called Elizabeth Rees, and it's the 200th anniversary of Lafayette come back to America in 1824. Nice. When he visited the then 24 states that you had. So that's for August 2024.
Cool. All right. How about you, Haley? Where can people find you?
HugoGirlPodcast.com and Hugo Girl Podcast on all the socials, and Nerds of a Feather on their socials and their website. I do movie reviews and the occasional Star Wars show recap.
Nice. All right. Well, thank you both for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was fun.
All right. Merci beaucoup, Seth.
Yes. All right. Bye.
Au revoir.
See y'all later.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Emmanuel and Haley, and I do definitely hope that you check out some Jules Verne. Fascinating author, great history of the genre as well, just to kind of see where the genre came from. And I absolutely encourage you to check out Emmanuel's podcast about, you know, all the historical background about the author. It was really, really good stuff. And, you know, he's got many, many other great episodes on a lot of topics that mostly we didn't learn in school as Americans. And of course, check out Hugo Girl as well. If you like what I do here and you have not checked them out, you're going to like what they do there. And then, you know, we do it slightly differently, and that's cool. But I think that's going to do it for this time. So thank you so much for listening. Bye, everyone.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.